Hi, this is Paul. I made this video last week about Bishop Barron and the TV show Mrs. Davis, and I knew there'd be some strong reaction, and there was, and they're in the comments section. Blasphemy, demonic, to describe the show Mrs. Davis. And I very much understand where those comments come from. What really surprises me, and this is part of the reason that I made the video, and I'm going to talk about it some more. I'm going to talk about it. There's just a whole number of aspects in there, but what really surprised me in all of this was Bishop Barron's response to it. Because, I was around for the release of The Life of Brian. There was a huge outcry when The Life of Brian was released. I was around for the release of The Last Temptation of Christ. There was a huge outcry against The Last Temptation of Christ. And just recently, Bishop Barron made a video against the LA Dodgers and this group, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. And Bishop Barron was very firmly against that. And so not only did he just mention this video, this TV series once in my current favorite show, Mrs. Davis, but the comments that he made in this the listener question one, and particularly he tends to focus on the He tends to focus on the AI aspect, but then what he said about the representation of Sister Simone's relationship with Jesus, again, is it because I'm a Protestant? Is it,
It's actually, I think, my favorite part of the show. It doesn't really have anything to do with the main theme of artificial intelligence, but throughout this show, Sister.
Now he's right. It doesn't have anything to do with the main theme of artificial intelligence, but I am not 100% sure that the main theme of that show is artificial intelligence. And that's part of the reason that I continue to be surprised at how I just simply don't think Bishop Barron understands this TV show, even though he watched the whole thing apparently with other Catholic priests, because I think the show centers on the Grail. And I think the show centers on. And I think you have to understand the way that the show handles the Grail as the interpretive key of the show.
Simone's relationship with Jesus, who
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
by the way, appears in the series. I won't say more than
Yeah.
that, but this is one of the first secular shows.
And again, I'm going to be totally okay with spoilers here. I don't care if I, and again, Anselman, none of this is a recommendation to watch the show. In fact, I just found myself even rather disturbed about the show. And for these reasons that, and I'm asking seriously, and I expect, feedback from some of our, some of the Roman Catholics in our audience. I'm thinking about Laura and Cale here. Sorry, Cale, to always make you the Catholic guy, but I just found it disturbing.
Was I've ever seen that displays and takes seriously the mystical spousal relationship between a religious sister and Christ. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I don't want to give away too much, but you're right. It in a way that was, I think,
And the way it's, maybe Sam will have something to say because of his aunt with respect to this and what Sam's take was.
unprecedented. I don't know anywhere really outside of like the mystical literature that you'd see. Yeah, we're taking seriously a kind of husband and wife language of mutual commitment language of deep, real intimacy between Christ and his spouse. So I think.
And again, if you just take it at that sort of shallow level of Christ and his spouse, yes, but that wasn't what the show was like with respect to Simone's relationship with Jay, as she would call him, and then the boss behind the door, which turns out.
Yeah, that was fascinating. And I think for a young woman interested in religious life might find that kind of compelling.
And again, I can understand watching a show, kind of being excited about a show, and then, you know, after a few days or a few weeks, you think back on the show and you think, no, he makes two videos about this and he talks about this. Now, I think an aspect of this is also sort of the I'm going to use this word, and I know just by the comment section already, this is going to draw some interesting conversation, the meta-modern aspect of this show. What do I mean by meta-modern? Well, again, as I've said many times in the comments section, the cement isn't dry with respect to our agreement on the naming of this. I sort of like Richard Beck's post-progressive, but especially with respect to art and film, Mrs. Davis is extremely meta-modern. What do I mean by that? So a number of weeks ago, someone sent me, "Why do movies feel so differently now?" And I've watched this two or three times. I actually watched this video with my wife yesterday, and it seemed to really grab her attention. Now, also as a follow-up to this, you should definitely watch Damian Walter's take, you know, kind of response to this video about what metamodern is, and that just illustrates the fact that the terms aren't really set, but the sensibilities seem there. So let's play a little bit of Thomas Flight's video here.
This is the metamodern era of film.
You got this.
What really makes Top Gun feel like a throwback is its complete lack of irony, self-consciousness, or self-doubt. There's no subversion of well-established tropes. There's not a big twist where we find out Maverick is actually the bad guy. It's not an anti-hero story. It's a sequel to another well-known film, but it's a sequel of pretty much the most...
Okay, now all those things he described, sort of the big twists and the subversion, all of that is in Mrs. Davis. And so it feels postmodern. Mrs. Davis feels extremely postmodern. Now, again, Damian Walter will say, no, actually, Top Gun Maverick is metamodern, but let's play a little more.
Straightforward kind imaginable. There's no spin-off or multiverse here. Top Gun Maverick is a rare thing these days. I think it's what we could call a modernist movie. And modernism is the thing they don't make them like anymore. In this video, I'm going to argue that the shift in how movies feel can be described as a shift first from modernism to postmodernism, and then from postmodernism into the metamodernism we see now. To really understand that shift and what metamodernism looks like in film, we first need to broadly understand both modernism and postmodernism in film, because metamodernism is reacting to both of them and incorporating both of them into itself.
Okay, and I think Thomas Flight's video is just an absolutely terrific introduction to these ideas. It's well-crafted. It makes the point clearly.
All three of the big isms we're talking about here are kind of hard to pin down. Philosophers, art critics, and media critics all disagree on what exactly they are and how to best describe them. Some people refer to modernism, postmodernism, and metamodernism as eras of thought, philosophy, or even art movements. Some academics refer to these three as structures of feeling, and that's the sense in which I'm going to be using them in this video. A structure of feeling is essentially a culture-wide vibe that encompasses philosophy, politics, design, and most importantly for this video, art. So in the case of modernism, we're giving a name to a specific culture-wide vibe.
Okay, so this culture-wide feeling, this culture-wide vibe, if you watch Mrs. Davis, it's full of that. It's also full of sincerity. And I think the show feels very now in that it has all of this stuff sort of, has all the post-modernity integrated in it. But as Thomas Flight notes here, part of the reason post-modernity can't be lived in, and C.S. Lewis pointed this out in the mid-20th century, part of the reason this can't be lived in is because you see through things in order to see to something, and you have to live somewhere. You can't simply live continually deconstructing everything. The hermeneutic of suspicion has to stop because Otherwise, you sort of devolve into suspicion in the way that I talked about a little bit in the Paralandra video, where Lewis makes the observation that some of these sensibilities, some of these deconstructive sensibilities, they're corrosive by design, and they're corrosive intentionally. And it's not a bad thing that they're corrosive. Critique has its point, and you'll find Jesus critiquing all sorts of things. So critique and solvents have their point, but the point of them is to get rid of corruption and to finally find the genuine article, to finally find the thing behind or above or beneath or whatever it is that's being obscured by whatever it is we're trying to see through or see past.
That starts to show up in philosophy with Descartes as early as the 1600s, and then continues through to Nietzsche, but which really shows up in culture and art from the 1900s to the 1940s. Film itself is a modernist medium. The technology started to emerge right as modernism was hitting the culture. In the same way science and reason seemed to provide a more objective view of reality than tradition did, photography seems to provide a more objective image of the world than paintings did.
And that objectivity, again, we've talked about that right from the start on this channel in terms of sort of a monarchical vision. Now, if we reintroduce the attention we've been paying to attention, one of the things that film subtly does, and you might even say deceptively does, and this is exactly where the postmodern critique really has its bite, is that the film offers a pre-volitional apprehension of the world. The filmmaker is directing our attention, and what film has is this incredible capacity to subtly focus, to blur and focus. I showed this last time with respect to, if I cover my face, now you get to see my hand. The film has the camera has the capacity. Come on, you can do it. I just got to keep my face covered. Anyway, the camera has the capacity to draw our attention and to manipulate our attention, to form our attention, to do all this. And even in early films where the technology is still rudimentary, as we've talked about with respect to cognitive science, the world is just too large. And so it's no accident that we keep talking about frames, because with a film, you seriously have a frame, but unlike a painting on the wall of a museum, you don't see the frame, because the frame is the screen and the frame is the theater and the frame is the frame is in a sense invisible with film. And so with modernity, you have this sense of certainty that this is exactly what there is. And you see this all the time with, let's say, Bigfoot or UFOs or Oak Island or anything where there's something sort of obscured and you're looking for a revelation, and people are like, well, I want to see a picture. So then of course you have, was it the Magruder film of Bigfoot walking? And then, oh no, that's a dude in an ape suit. And so, and now of course, once Photoshop came along, then it was, well, photographs don't mean anything. And now that we have AI, they completely don't mean anything. Modernism convinced us of the possibility of a monarchical vision and the certainty of seeing. Okay, so that's sort of the modernism. We'll play a little bit more.
And in a sense, film being 24 photos a second presented the most startlingly real and immersive images art had ever been able to create. I think in this way, the form of film kind of ideologically aligned with modernist philosophies that promoted this idea of an objective view of reality.
So, and of course, film then becomes a tremendous power in terms of propaganda. In the 20th century, very quickly, governments and regimes realize the power of this medium, and they're going to employ it.
Since there's no new marshal to replace him yet, and he believes Stang is the smart up, Frank Miller has been released and is going to use, along with his superior jet flying skills, learning a lesson that other people can help.
I hate to do this without your new marshal being here.
In the 1952 film High Noon, U.S. Marshal Will Kane just got married and is about to give up his badge and leave town when he receives word that an outlaw he once locked up, Frank Miller, has been released and is going to arrive on the train at noon to take his revenge by killing Kane. For his new wife, who is a Quaker pacifist, the solution is simple, just leave town. But Kane has a sense of responsibility and duty to his station since there's no new marshal to replace him yet. And he believes staying is the smartest decision for him to make.
They're making me run. I've never run from anybody before.
The film is well staged and shot. It's pretty tense. There's
now, that wasn't really reason. It was identity and pride. And it was, as in the modern frame, it was a certainty of mission. There's no equivocation. There's no uncertainty. This is something that Tim Keller, when he was looking at the difference between Lord of the Rings in the book and Lord of the Rings in the movie, the Lord of the Rings movie finds Aragorn just continually wrestling over his identity and his mission and his role. And in some ways, he just sort of keeps backing into it. And Tim Keller noted that in Tolkien's book, Aragorn knows his mission. He knows his identity. He knows his role, and he's going to fulfill it. Now, it's important to note, and Thomas Flight lays this out quite well, you have traditional, then modernity, then postmodernity, and then, of course, this metamodern, which what I think we sort of see happening in this little corner is the metamodern is sort of coming back into the traditional. And so we see something of a circle. And this might, in fact, be sort of a generational circle that's operating.
There's a decent amount of nuance here. It's a classic Western. But in the broad strokes, through the power of his determination to take a stand that nobody else will, there's that American individualism again, and his dedication to honor, along with his superior gunslinging skills, Kane is able to defeat the bad guy, but not before he learns the lesson that other people can help out too sometimes. This is a great example, I think, because it shows how modernism is itself responding to traditional values.
And not just traditional values, but again, what Thomas Flight really does nicely here is show how religion sort of steps away and allows the modernist assertion and modernist certainty to in some ways trump religious values and religious tradition.
I know it's against your religion, though.
Amy ultimately rejects her Quaker beliefs in pacifism in order to side with Kane's.
Now, in this little modern dance that we do, she might not reject her Quaker beliefs, but she violates them. She violates her Quaker pacifism. Now, she might, in the modern frame, continue to maintain them, and she might say something like, I had no choice but to do that. I remain a Quaker, but I had to kill him.
Modernist values, which are grounded in his sense of civic duty to the democratic government. The movie.
Okay, and there's the trumping. That's the value at the top of the hierarchy.
He strongly puts forward that Kane being a good marshal has clearly made the town a better place.
And so that's then his identity, that's his role, and, well, there's no room for that in Quakerism, is there?
Town up, you made it fit for women and kids to live in.
Modernism is looking at traditional governments, art, and religion, and saying a lot of this seems kind of flawed.
Why aren't you in church?
Why ain't you?
And if we apply the tools of...
And I had never noticed that scene before, and he dropped it right in there. And there it is. Why aren't you in church, Wall? And so actually, in terms of Protestant history, there's room for the marshal in certain Protestant beliefs, let's say like Calvinism, where the town itself has a role, but not so much in pacifism and Quakerism. So then very quickly you have some eschatological questions that sort of linger with respect to some of these particulars among the Protestant menu.
Of science, flawed.
Why aren't you in church?
Why ain't you?
And if we apply the tools of science, reason, and rationalism, we can become...
And so it's First I'm going to hit you because I'm playing the performative traditional role, but we know that that our new knowledge means Church is inessential and archaic and something along the way.
More enlightened beings that have a more objective understanding of the truth and are therefore better and make the world a better place because of it.
Parson, you got anything to say?
I don't know.
Here, traditional religion is depicted as not really having answers for the moral dilemma that Cain is facing.
The right and the wrong seem pretty clear here. But if you're asking me to tell my people to go out and kill, and maybe get themselves killed, I'm sorry. I don't know what to say.
Instead, the film's sense that Cain is making the right decision is grounded in a kind of democratic weighing of different views.
There's a difference of opinion, let everybody have a say. But let's do it like grown-up people.
And ultimately Cain's own reasoning. But the movie isn't just modernist in its values, it's also modernist in another way, its storytelling structure. What's really surprising about watching a film like this now, 70 years later, is not just its unabashedly sincere advocation for honor, duty, and being able to shoot really good, it's that there are pretty much no twists. It just sets up its story, and then good guy wins, bad guy loses.
And that, of course, is key. And it's key in terms of the motivation of the watcher. I've talked about this quite a bit with respect to YouTube, how as I have this YouTube channel and as I watch the comments and as I watch the community formation and as I watch the different elements of the community sort of happen, there's always this question, well, why do people watch this YouTube? Even though we've seen the woke, anti-woke stuff 1,000 times. Why do you always go to your, let's say, your anti-woke channel? Or it's the same thing with respect to the wokesters. Why do you always go to the channel that believes exactly what you believe and will come to exactly the conclusion you expect them to come to and to demonstrate and argue for the conclusion that you all agree on? What is it about preaching to the choir that keeps the choir coming back? And that's key in terms of this movement here. This is in some ways Church. And again, as a preacher, I've seen that, where one of the things that you very quickly learn as a pastor is give the people what they expect. And now again, many people would look at this movie and just by a whole bunch of elements of the movie, they would say, well, this movie is designed to do exactly what we want it to do. So is Top Gun Maverick. Maverick is not going to get shot down. Maverick is going to best the bad guys. Now, again, is Maverick modernist or metamodern? And I'll leave that to some of the film critics, and I'll think about it too. But what's interesting here, again, is that in the postmodern moment, the predictability of High Noon is a negative. But for the people who are going to watch High Noon, it's a positive. But now there are predictabilities within postmodernism as well that its audiences are coming to see. They are looking for the subversion. They are looking for the plot twist. And if the subversion doesn't happen, if the plot twist doesn't happen, the film loses status in their eyes, just like for the devotees of High Noon, if the script isn't followed, if the good guys don't win the bad guys, and against all the tension in the film is held by, will the good guy win? Will the good guy win? Well, the good guy has to win, but we're setting up a situation where it doesn't seem possible the good guy will win. And in High Noon, he's severely outnumbered and the town won't back him and he doesn't have any deputies around him. And, even his pacifist Quaker wife, I remember the Band of Brothers show, which was I really enjoyed Band of Brothers, that HBO series on the Second World War. And one guy kept saying, no, it wasn't Band of Brothers. It was, again, Spielberg is very interesting in this. And again, when we talk about the Grail, we're going to have to talk about Indiana Jones. Spielberg's very interesting in this because Spielberg tends to appeal, now we're going to use these words, sensitivities and sensibilities. Spielberg tends to appeal to the modernist, straightforward sensibilities, and the whole key to making an exciting traditional movie where you have the white hats and the black hats, even though Gary Cooper there has a black hat. The sensibilities is you raise the tension up so that it looks absolutely impossible for the hero to triumph, but the hero will triumph. And so this isn't just a matter of, see, there are frames, of course, on the videos and the critiques we give. And it's, we're so conditioned, we're so culturally attuned to the deconstructivist culture that it is a knock on the storytelling if we say it's predictive. Even though, as I said, with respect to church, with respect to preaching, with respect to tradition, the predictive quality of it is in fact reinforced and sought after by the devotees of the community. And again, you see this in politics too. You know, appeal to the base, appeal to the base. The Democrats do it, the Republicans do it. It's a feature, not a bug.
For audiences who have grown up on postmodern and metamodern media, this is going to feel uncannily straightforward. I want to be clear about two things. First, I don't think every movie during the early period of film is a modernist one. I think there were even some postmodern films during this time, although the language to describe them as that didn't exist yet. And second,
and that's the same with respect to the metamodern. That's where we're at right now. We don't have the language to quite describe what's going on. We're seeing it going on. Our poets, our artists are trying to describe it. They're presenting it to us. They have all of these new mediums in order to present it, but we're still struggling with it.
Second, I don't think these filmmakers were intentionally engaging with modernism or trying to make modernist stories. They just existed in a largely modernist culture. And so,
and again, we are formed. There's another word that begins with G that means formed, but I'm not going to use it because that's been used in a whole lot of other things. We are formed now beyond this to look back and say, oh, they're so simple. And this runs, so some of the other videos that I hope to make today, this runs through the fight in the Christian Reformed Church right now. The progressives will look at the traditionalists and they'll say, you know, either they're bigoted, which means that they have a moral defect, or they're unintelligent or uneducated. So, oh, poor things, God bless them, it's not their fault. They just haven't been, they have not benefited by all the privilege that we have. So it's our job to sort of the elite's burden. It's our job to bring them along until they finally believe what we believe.
Those modernist values and ideas came through in the kinds of stories they told. The important takeaway here is that this general traditional story structure, advocacy of specific values, and generally optimistic feeling was the dominant one in film for a while. And this is largely the modernism that postmodernism in film is responding to. To get a handle on what postmodernism in film looks like, let's look at No Country for Old Men, one of my favorite postmodernist movies, which deconstructs the Western and is a great comparison to High Noon.
Call it.
In this neo-Western, Gon is the villain with the straightforward motive of a grudge. In his place is an aimless, imposing figure who seems to have no morality beyond the arbitrary whims of fate.
Now, part of what's ironic, I was thinking about this morning, part of what's ironic about sort of this postmodern sensibility is that on one hand, it tends to leverage sort of the modernist optimism that people are basically good. But what that doesn't afford is, well, where do all the bigots come from? And what it doesn't afford is, where do all these evil come from? And so the evil are very much otherized. But you see this also sort of inverted and subverted as well sometimes in postmodernism, that there's a justification story, there's a formation story with respect to the evil that the postmoderns are actually very inconsistent on this, because on one hand they want to say that evil is this horrible monstrosity, we don't know where it comes from, but it must be completely eliminated, or evil is such a evil is just a people who have lacked the privilege of moral or educational formation that has them actually transcend above good and evil. And so there's no real evil, there's just poor education. And you find, just like the inconsistency between the bigot and the rube, that's basically the same parallelism. The bigot, and in the case of, let's say, No Country for Old Men, is the monster. And the rube, well, that's the rube, and there's hope for the rube, but there's no hope for the monster. The monster simply has to be killed.
High Noon, there's this character, the older previous marshal before Cain.
If you're honest, you're poor your whole life. And in the end, you wind up dying all alone on some dirty street.
You can almost hear him giving voice to the postmodernist anxiety that would have been starting to arise in the 50s. But while High Noon brushes this character aside in favor of Cain's modernist sense of morality, in No Country for Old Men, it's this world-weary perspective that takes center stage in the form of the sheriff.
Oh, that's all right. I laugh myself sometimes. Ain't a whole lot else you can do.
Cain's confidence, self-assurance, and unwavering conviction about right and wrong is replaced by a sheriff who does his job, but laments the state of things, wondering if he even wants to be a part of the world he sees around him. Llewellyn, the other key protagonist, meanwhile, isn't a hero. He's not motivated by honor or duty. He's just trying to get away with a bag of money that he accidentally found. This isn't a gunslinger, but a gunslinger deconstructed. I'm not going to spoil the movie, but let's just say it doesn't unfold with the kind of Hollywood ending we get in High Noon. Instead, things just unspool as if the outcome of the plot was decided by the flip of a coin. If High Noon is saying the good guys will win because they have honor, duty, and determination, No Country for Old Men is a tad more nihilistic.
Now, if you get back to, let's say, Mrs. Davis, and I think this is the key movement away from the nihilism or the nihilism of postmodernity into whatever it is we're struggling to name and see right now, which is more of where a lot of a lot of cultural elites, cultural forefronts, poet, you know, the artists, whatever, what they're wrestling with. There's no nihilism in Mrs. Davis. Now, actually, I was thinking last night about this, and I began to go back to the conversations that I had with Nathan Jacob. Some of you might remember this video, which launched me to go find Nathan Jacobs, had a couple of conversations with him. He was busy, I was busy, we sort of lost track of each other. He talked to Peugeot not too long ago. But he, one of the things that he pointed out was Life itself, the movie Life itself. Now this came out. He played the trailer for Life itself for the priests at the conference. But Life itself. So what Nathan Jacob is doing here, he's sort of analyzing The Nuns and the Duns, and he noted that life has a pattern, that the nuns and the duns at some point pull themselves up out of nihilism or never dip that low, and they have a whole bunch of ideas such as everything happens for a reason, which is sort of a poor man's guard against nihilism.
It really is beautiful. And it really does capture...
He's talking about the movie Life itself. He had just played the trailer for it.
that reconciliation of the meaningfulness of life that the nuns are grappling with the problem of evil. I mentioned that the shocking moment in early in the film was not gratuitous, and it's because it deals in many ways with the problem of evil. And
the movie I watched, so after I talked to him, I watched the movie. It's a very powerful movie. And the movie, I won't spoil that movie, even though I have no problem spoiling Mrs. Davis. That movie basically really pushes this idea, everything happens for a reason, takes you on a long, circuitous route to make a seemingly senseless loss make sense and have value in a bigger picture.
So this is where, if you really want to understand the heart of the nun's worldview, I think this is the best picture of that you could possibly see. It's compelling, it's beautiful, and one of the things that I think is so telling about it is that what you begin to see is that for the nuns, everything doesn't work out well for everyone in the film. This is part of the whole point, that the world is meaningful doesn't necessarily mean that it works out for me, but somehow the grander mosaic works out, which is a surprising twist from, say, rugged individualism, right? That's a shocking turn in thought. The second element of this commitment to karma, what they're calling karma, is that if you do good things will happen to you. If you do bad things will happen to you. Okay. Now, this is obviously closely related to the first, right? That what we do sends ripples out, and what other people do, sends ripples our way. But the world is self-correcting, right? That is one of their convictions. And what is key to this is that good is rewarded and evil is punished. Ultimately, it may take time, but ultimately, it's self-correcting. Now, notice this is a conviction that justice is critical to a meaningful world, right? It's not just that the world is meaningful, but in order for it to be meaningful, it has to be just in the sense that good is rewarded and evil is punished. But also important to this, and this is what sets up the second conviction that I think is critical to the nun's worldview, is that this justice is dispassionate and impersonal, okay? So this is where we move from karma, the first...
Now, that's really key, what he made just there. Well, I'll let him finish it, because it's a really important point.
...feature of the nun's worldview, and what they mean by that. To the shift to a higher power, right? Away from God, right? A personal deity, to a higher power, and a non-anthropomorphic, rejection of anthropomorphic deity or divinity.
So let's talk about Mrs. Davis. Because Mrs. Davis, in many ways, is an atheistic movie. And this is why I think that Bishop Barron and his friend have Sister Simone and Jay completely wrong. Jay is not the son of God in this movie. Jay is mystical. Jay is romantic. Jay, but the ogre behind the door, who will wind up being perhaps Mary, the mother of Jay. In other words, the movie sort of slips into a Freudian. She's Jay's mother, but there is no God, but what there is again, and this is completely, I think, the current sensibility we have in our culture with respect to the nuns and the duns. In other words, I don't think Mrs. Davis points to anything like Bishop Barron or the Roman Catholic Church or the church in general point to. I think it's fundamentally a godless universe with magic and enchantment and all of these other things that sort of the metamodern, if we're going to use that word, or the post-progressive, is it neo-traditional? Is it neo-pagan? again, there's sort of a circular aspect to this. That's where Mrs. Davis is. And so when the Word on Fire people look at this and say, wow, look at that, I think, no, I don't think, I think the audience is going to drink in not what you hope it will in this. Mrs. Davis, now you have this whole, and again, Bishop Barrett talks about this forever, itchy, but then, interestingly enough, at the end of the video, I was thinking about the fact that we use, is a ship is a her. We gender ships. We use, and in fact, I forget what it was at the end of the video that Bishop Barron was doing. He was talking about him, again, with a non-human referent later in the video. So this whole it, she thing that they sort of really start out the movie with and that Bishop Barron, you know, just really camps on to begin with. No, that's not going to be the big thing. What am I looking for? I can't. We have to get to. Yeah, what a crazy show. Okay, so Sister Simone in real life's former live-in boyfriend and continual lover, because there's this whole show where this is all element where Sister Simone is about to have sex with her old boyfriend lover, and she's talking to Jesus, and Jesus is like, hey, it's cool if you have sex with your boyfriend. It's like, is Word on Fire really down with this? You know, and again, I don't want to lean too hard on that because they gave all those disclaimers. I get it. But again, this representation is like, no, but it's completely of the spirituality of the moment. That's what this is. And so he basically, one of the things that you can do to earn your wings in this app, your buffalo wings, to earn your wings in this app is to basically give your life to the algorithm, give you life to the corporation. And so then you get a tattoo. And that tattoo basically says that there's an expiration date and you have to show up for the corporation and they're going to take your life. And so, you know, this adds all of this tension. And this then brings into, remember the Jordan Peterson conversation he had about psychedelics, where with psychedelics, you have to know your death. And there's obviously a Christian element to that too. Remember your death, memento mori, all of that stuff. Well, there's an element to that in the show as well. And so he has this tattoo, and she discovers that he has basically sold his life to the algorithm so that he gets wings on the app and everybody, like in this Pokemon Go thing, can see him with the wings on the app. But he didn't do it for that reason, and he started this crazy group of men. Okay, so you've got this binary between Sister Simone and the sisters, the Catholic sisters, who are the ones. And again, and Bishop Barron's like, they're off the grid. Isn't that lovely? Yeah, but don't forget the dudes who are in the bunker in the museum who are doing the same thing. So on one hand, you have all the crazy spiritual women who are all into growing strawberries and making organic things. And you have the dudes in the museum and the bunker. So they're sort of like the new atheists, and the women are sort of like the new agers. And that's who they are. And so Sister Simone is not Catholic. Sister Simone is new age. But they both have to come together, and they both come together, both the new agers and the new atheists, they come together. And again, this is post-nihilism in that he has to show up to this place. And so, you know, he gets a chance to sort of get out of it, but he's full of pride. He's a new atheist in that sense. He's full of pride, and so he won't. And so he has to, like, strap into this roller coaster thing. And they have him totally convinced that it's going to take his life. But then at the end, no, they don't. Now he's learned his lesson, and he will get to go through. See, there's a spoiler for you. You know, he doesn't die, and that surprised me zero. It surprised me zero from the show. And, you know, he has to give his life to Mrs. Davis. But again, Mrs. Davis is personal or faux personal, and there is no God in this. And this, again, is why it's important that this is a Grail story. And why? I mean, the Grail is the key that runs through the story. Now, it is not a faithful Grail story. So I've listened to, you know, I've started listening to all of the Grail stuff that this little corner has put together. And if I always include Tom Holland in this little corner to one degree or another. But the Grail is the container for the body of Christ. Again, watch Peugeot and Roland. It's the stone that Jesus is laid in on the tomb. It is the platter. It is the serving platter that can hold a fish. It is the cup that holds the blood of Christ. That is what the Grail is. The Grail is deeply tied to the Eucharist. Tom Holland draws those connections in his show on the Holy Grail. It's deeply tied to the Eucharist. But even though there's a Jesus in this thing, it's Jesus sort of ripped out of the Christian story and made to be sort of another religious thing. But again, religion in this is fundamentally instrumental in terms of seeking human meaning. And that's what Mrs. Davis is. The whole justification for Mrs. Davis is that Mrs. Davis sends people out on these altruistic missions in order to earn their social media status or their wings. That's the whole thing behind Mrs. Davis. And so, again, unlike the frame that was set up for me by Bishop Barron recommending this movie, where this movie is about a takedown of AI, no. This movie is, even though, yeah, Mrs. Davis will shut herself off. And then at the end of the show, when Mrs. Davis finally does shut herself off, there's all of this question about the chaos that is going to reign. And I can't. Yeah, if I could play a clip, I'd play a clip, but then I'd never get it through.
And cut. Cut.
But another reason that Greg proposed for why metamodernism is developing that I agree with is that it isn't just a response to postmodernism, it's also simultaneously a response to something we could call hypermodernism. You have modernity, then postmodernism kind of comes along, but it's modernity doesn't just stop existing then.
Right.
I mean, it kind of continues as a thread that now is still this thing that we would describe as hyper-modernity.
Yeah, everything everywhere all at once. Its whole, you know, metaphor of the multiple realities, I think, is a metaphor for the way life in the real world often feels like we're in multiple realities. And so
whereas Bishop Barron and Word on Fire think, oh, this sort of gets at this union with Christ. It's like, no, this doesn't get at union with Christ. This gets at the hypermodern, that they're not going to segment the religion off, but they're certainly not. And they're going to, I mean, she's going to close her eyes and then she's going to be with Jay, and either they're having nice food together. I mean, her relationship with Jay, first of all, she sort of starts out getting her missions from Jay, how to rescue people from the magicians. And then most of her relationship with Jay is, you know, food and enjoyment. It's like dating. And then suddenly, wait a minute. Jay has all these other wives. And you know, I don't talk about all these other wives with you. That's the rules. I was like, well, we've got rules now. And you can sleep with your once living boyfriend. I mean, don't feel bad about that. And it's hypermodern.
The insane pace of change and of narrative switching and flipping and points of view, and to be able to be aware of the points of view of people from all over the world and people who have diametrically opposed political views to you, all coming at you is something that we have to deal with very much now, and it threatens to pull apart your sense of self. Now we make art that's not just protecting the self from other art that was undermining the self, right, but we make art that protects the sense of self from the world that we live in moment to moment as we just go about our lives.
Whatever modernity was has continued and in some senses intensified. Mm-hmm. You have people who are trying to deconstruct those things. They continue kind of in this other trajectory, but they don't necessarily negate each other. One doesn't get to win culturally.
Right. And all of the traditional stuff is still right there.
Right. It's still right there as well.
The traditional stuff, we would die.
Right.
I mean, that's just the basic fabric that's.
And in a sense, there it is. And that's why in some ways there's a circular aspect to this where at the end of it, we just recognize, oh, we need the traditional. And I think that's part of the reason why we see this, you know, that those who are coming out of nihilism, is it metamodern? Is it traditional? We can't quite tell. But and in that way, the fact that Mrs. Davis seemed to dupe Bishop Barron, wow, that's really interesting. I've got a world of respect for Bishop Barron. But again, when I saw not one but two videos about this, I thought, he's not seeing this clearly. And we're still going to have to get into the Grail stuff.
Right. Holding everything together.
The hypermodern world is one where, because of the internet and social media, we're constantly inundated with traditional modernist and postmodernist narratives all at once. The digital citizen has a perspective of the world that was never before possible. This is something I talk about in the video I made about hypermodernism and Everything Everywhere All at Once last year. Metamodernism, I think, is an attempt to make sense of this new perspective, to pick and choose positive elements from each of these old...
There it is. It's pick and choose positive elements. It's exactly what Mrs. Davis is doing, but it's picking and choosing across the broad array. And so you have characters all along the way. Early on in the movie, they have these Germans who are hunting down this woman. Well, they're paid by sort of the Luddite anti-Mrs. Davis new atheists, of which Sister Simone's ex-boyfriend is. And again, in all of these elements, what it so often comes down to is the therapeutic. This is all about Sister Simone, and, you know, look at Burnham here. This is all about Sister Simone healing her relationship with her mother. This is all about Sister Simone reconciling her relationship with her father, her mother who, you know, wound up shooting her. This is all about Sister Simone. It's all about Sister Simone. She is the center of it, and she is at heart a young girl who is trying to heal the wounds of the past. I've got to stop now, but again, I want to do another video, and again, next week my vacation starts, and I also know that once vacation starts, whether any of these projects that I have picked up now will be taken up, because after a month of doing different things and having vacation and having other events, we've got that event in Washington, D.C., I think tickets are still available. Who knows what I'll be thinking about when I get back? Then I usually make videos about what I'm thinking about. But again, I think, just to say a couple of things about the Grail. The Grail seems to be a revelatory initiator. I watched portions of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which is the one of the Holy Grail in, and you watch how the Grail is treated and what the Grail is and how the Grail functions in storytelling there, and it's revelatory. And then you compare that to, let's say, the Grail in Monty Python, or now the Grail in Mrs. Davis. The story of the Grail and Mrs. Davis, I think, has everything to do with what Bishop Barron is hoping to find in Mrs. Davis, and it won't be found there. And I think the Grail is the tell about what the Grail is, what it does, because I think in many ways, the Grail, even in a piece of work like Mrs. Davis, the Grail continues to reveal the truth about the piece of work itself and those who are holding it. So for Indiana Jones, the Grail, like the Ark of the Covenant, is sort of sacred technology. It's sacred. You can't really wield it, but you can a little bit, and Indy does. And go ahead and listen to Peugeot and Roland talk about relics and how relics aren't just technology. The Grail in Mrs. Davis is fundamentally evil and has to be destroyed. And really, instead of... I really liked what Richard Roland did with Parsifal in the second part of his conversation with Peugeot. And I think I found... Now, I'm easy to convince because I haven't... I'm a neophyte with respect to the Grail stuff. Mrs. Davis is on a quest to destroy the Grail. Not to preserve it in some cave with some never-ending crusader, but to destroy it. It must be destroyed. It's an evil that had to be lived with, and in the end, it must be destroyed, and the hero of the story destroys the Grail. And I think, in many ways, the Grail in this story is God. And God must finally be eliminated. Mrs. Davis will also be eliminated. And even so, the wounds of the child, the all-grown-up child, have not been fully healed and probably never will be, which makes sort of her religious order really just sort of a New Age fixture. Now, it happens sometimes that I make these videos and the people who make a show like Mrs. Davis will send me an email. So if that happens, I'll talk about it. If I've got it wrong, I'm open to correction. But this is why you put out art. This is why you don't necessarily... This is why you put out art and then everybody takes a whack at it. And then the person who put out art has to explain it. Believe me, as a preacher, I have that often. This is what I said in my sermon. But Pastor, you said this. Well, didn't mean to say that. That wasn't really what I meant. So, yeah, it's the danger of putting out anything that's open to interpretation in the court of public opinion. But I think for many people who, on the basis of Bishop Barron's recommendation, started watching Mrs. Davis and sort of went, huh? And it was a... It was... I found it finally disturbing. And I think... And I'm not exactly sure what. I think Mrs. Davis's ending was supposed to land. Is it a Hollywood ending? Sort of. So the big baddie of AI is dismissed. The lie of AI is dismissed. But what that means is that people are left sort of in their messes. And again, when finally AI is, you know, here's this dude screaming at his phone because Mrs. Davis is no longer answering, giving him guidance. And so there's all these other scenes. Yeah. All right. That's enough of this for now. I've got a conversation to do. I just by the fact that I made another video about this, some of you are going to be upset. Maybe too upset to leave a comment. We'll see. But I hope you watched it to the end because, yeah, I'm still working through this. So anyway, leave a comment.